Hello, you're listening to a Zen Studies Society podcast. To learn more about our community of Zen Buddhist practitioners, please visit zenstudies.org.
Shūmonakatto shū dai 64 sok mū kodoku wa dharma daishi ryō no bute ni mamiyo te to chin tera o tatte sō o dōsu nan no kudoku ka aru maibaku mū kudoku. Entangling vines. Case 64, no merit. When Bodhidharma met Emperor Wu of Liang, the emperor asked, I have founded temples and ordained monks. What merit have I gained from these acts? Bodhidharma answered, no merit. Welcome. On this afternoon of the first day of our Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial Session, it's always amazing to come here to walk down 2nd Ave here on the Upper East Side in the midst of this cauldron that we call New York City. There is this place, an old carriage house where you sit now, where the horses used to be. Maybe the same amount of shit nowadays as then. But it's such a place of silence and of. It's an oasis, that's how I feel here. It's an oasis. Not walking away from something, but we are walking into a fullness rather than into a safe room that keeps things out. Our mind is pretty good at keeping things out if we don't listen. Our hearts easily like to cut things out that they are not yet able to embrace. But when we come here, it's just a different fullness, at least in my experience. I hope you taste that as well. And the walls tell stories from all the human beings who have sat here. So many since 1968. Many, many periods of Zazen, many sutras chanted, countless prostrations. Did we gain any merit from those acts? If we listen to Bodhidharma, the answer is, nah, no merit. So we have to look at that a little bit, and why does the word merit even appear in this practice? What about karma? Isn't merit one side of the karma bank? The good stuff and the bad stuff, the things that we have to purify. Oh, if it were that easy. If it were that easy and mechanical, it would be fairly straightforward, but it's not. It's not. At least in this practice. There are many, many other paths, other belief systems, other philosophies, other religions that make it easier. You could go to auditing with Scientology and pay for progression. You could buy indulgence if you were in the Middle Ages from the Catholic Church. So many ways, even in Japan or in the Buddhism that we could call religious Buddhism, there are these ideas that we could pray for something. We could accumulate good karma or bad karma and all of that. But from the point of view of the Zen school, no merit means no bad karma, no good karma anywhere else than where? Here, here, right now, right now. So who appears here besides Bodhidharma? I'm sure you have heard about Bodhidharma, right? There is a picture of him in this building. Have you seen it? Yeah, it's hanging out in the stairwell, if you look carefully. And when you look at it, you might take a step back because you think, oh, this thing is heavy. It might fall down. It hasn't fallen down yet. If you look very carefully at that picture, he looks a little disheveled. And most of all, Bodhidharma is missing one shoe. He has only one shoe in that picture. Anyone know the story about the one shoe? Yeah. What is it? Oh, you don't know. Oh, your Bodhidharma. That's... Gion Sensei, do you know anything about the shoe? Did somebody steal it from the shoe rack out here because it wasn't locked?
People mostly leave shoes there.
Whole pairs.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, isn't the legend that one of the shoes was left in India? Expressing this connection that Bodhidharma was an Indian person from subcontinental India. It points to the many stories that we have in these various traditions. Bodhidharma himself, we don't even know if he existed as a person. Does it matter for the stories to go forward? No, not really. Stories are very important. I happened to speak to somebody about stories this morning. Sometimes we sit here in Zazen and think, oh, I have to get rid of all those stories that I tell all the time. But if that were really true, you would erase all the conditions of your life, of who you are, of what brought you here. More than that, we would wipe out all the stories we need to know about humanity. It's wonderful achievement, but even more so, it's recurring, recalcitrant failures. So stories are very helpful when it comes to look at our human condition. This koan is a story. It's a very short story. And in the story appears a person that might be a story himself. And since this is not an academic undertaking that we are in here, but our lives, it doesn't matter too much. So this Bodhidharma person He was pretty old when he left India and he made his trip to China. How did he get there? Did he take the bus? What about the Chinese high-speed rail? Nothing yet. It was very difficult to get from India to China. There are some foothills, you know, Mount Everest, those mountains that are not easy to cross. Even Bodhidharma couldn't do that. So what did he do? He went on a cruise, huh? Yeah, he took a ship. He came over the ocean to China. And that's where another story starts. So Buddhism seems to be a seafaring kind of propagation from India to China across the sea, from China to Japan across the sea, from Japan to North America across the sea, from North America also to Europe across the sea. Gyate, gyate, hara, gyate, hara, so, gyate, over, over to the other shore. Always forward in that liquid element, in the element we can't walk on, the element we can't grasp with our hands, the element that we can't build on. And once in it, we are completely subjected to the whim of the ocean, the wind, the waves. It's such an apt simile, a metaphor for the Dharma. You can't walk on the Dharma. You can't grasp it with your hands and hold on to it. But we can float. And with the right wind, we can float between continents, between places, between times. So when Bodhidharma came, he went around. There weren't books yet. If there were books, maybe he was on a book tour. But he didn't have a book. He only had the teaching of the 28 generations of his predecessors that go back to the historical Buddha. Tonight we will be chanting Tedai Denpo Busso no Myogo, the lineage that even starts before the Buddha. So there he is, making house calls to the emperors. Now, did he arrive in a place where there was no Buddhism? No, Buddhism has been in China already for some time. The first type of Buddhism that came to China did a lot of translating. So if you know about names such as Kumarajiva, who translated from the Sanskrit or the Pali into Chinese characters and pronunciation. That was the first wave. So it was very, very scriptorial. A lot of the things that were written down. The oldest sutra that exists in a printed way, the oldest printed book on this planet, is the Diamond Sutra that was found in the caves at Donghua in China. So that was the time of Buddhism before Bodhidharma came. So he was not the first one, but that new Zen school needed to be novel somehow, because there were so many other schools. So what happened over time is they assimilated some ideas of the country they came to. And that's what we will be talking about a little bit. So, but he came to this Emperor Wu of Liang. That's how it's transcribed if we use the Chinese translation. Well, there are no tones here I can't do. We don't even know how they spoke at that time. But in Japanese, the place was called Ryo, and Bute was the name of the emperor. Bute. So Bodhidharma, with his one shoe, appears in front of the emperor. And the emperor says to him, I have founded temples and ordained monks because Buddhism has been here for quite some time. What merit have I gained from these acts? Bodhidharma said, none. No merit. No merit for you. That's what he said. We have to appreciate how dangerous it was to say something like that. Because before Buddhism appeared in China, there was a very, very long time established system of philosophy, of life, of learning. Do you have any inkling what kind of system that was?
Confucianism,
yes. And the interesting thing is, Confucius is said or dated to have lived from 551 before the Common Era until 479. The historical Buddha, in the traditional dating of the long chronology going back from King Ashoka, would have lived from 563 before the Common Era until 483. So they were contemporaries. So when did Bodhidharma appear? About, just ballpark. Please.
Tang Dynasty, 550?
Yeah, 550, 5th, 6th century after the Common Time started. So that's almost 1,000 years into this, right? 1,000 years. That's a long time. So Chinese culture, Chinese philosophy, Chinese government, Chinese arts were steeped in the ideas of Confucianism. And merit and virtue are very, very important in Confucianism. So when we look at Confucianism, there are 5 virtues. In Japanese, gojo, 5 virtues. The first one is called jin. I think in the original would be ren. And that means, we could say, human-heartedness. It means that there is this belief that we all have a good nature as our innate nature. So a belief in the basic good nature of human beings. And it expresses itself in acts of benevolence, empathy, loving kindness, and compassion. The second one is gi, righteousness, or basically to do the right thing through connecting with others and the world, through that heart of the human-heartedness. The third one is rei, which means manners or ritual, a set of social rules, a set of rules and customs in the government, in arts, that manifest this human heartedness. The fourth one is qi, wisdom, which is being one with that human heartedness, with that jin. Just like two sides of a coin, one side is the wisdom, the other side is compassion. And the last one, shin, trustworthiness, the ability to be honest with oneself and others in living and by exemplifying it. And what we exemplify is the heart of the human heartedness. So that was there for 1,000 years. No wonder they liked Buddhism. Ren or Jin, the basic good human nature with benevolence, empathy, loving kindness, and compassion, is very close to Buddhist idea. First of all, of Buddha nature that we all have. But loving kindness, Maitri, and Karuna, and compassion, doing the right thing through it, is following the silas, the second paramita of Buddhism. Now comes rei, the manners or the ritual, a set of rules and customs through which this Buddha nature is manifested. Have you ever heard about something like that? There are people who put on strange robes. They carry around all kinds of implements and mount platforms, bow, chant, and all of that, following specific rules. That's also very close to this practice that we still have here. And as you might already intuit, is that a good part of that is the influence of Confucianism that was there to inform the Chinese Zen school as it established itself. I like to think of it from the point of view of a development, or let's say a chemical reaction that happens already, and you put it in a different environment. There are different kind of catalytic elements that make specific parts of the reaction become accelerated. And that happened here with Confucian thought and morals and philosophy and Buddhist practice. Wisdom, of course. Wisdom is one side, wisdom, compassion. Exactly the same. And the last one, the trustworthiness, to be honest with oneself and others in living by and making an example of that Buddha nature, is what our practice wants us to be able to do. Shin actually is the same shin. It's the human on the left-hand side in the radical for human, and on the right side it's word. And it's the same shin that you find in the great faith that Hakuin talks about. The great faith root, Dai Shin Kon. So there is a very close relationship here. So these first Zen people came into, let's say, a crowded marketplace of all different kinds of Buddhist traditions. There were people who did the Lotus Sutra. There were people who were experts on the Diamond Sutra. There were people who were doing the Vinaya, the monastic rules, and so on. How did Zen break into that marketplace? It needed a novel product, or it needed a novel way of selling the same old product. And what did they do? They looked around and said, Confucianism. filial piety, ancestry, is really, really important. By the way, we have an unbroken line back to the Buddha. Very good marketing in this Confucian era. Is it true, factually? Probably not. As a thought and as a story, most definitely. Most definitely. It is as true as we are all related by DNA. But we are not in the same family, even if we claim to be. So that was interesting how this came together. So, and ancestors were so important that, of course, it would be the best thing to have the Buddha himself for the first ancestor. You might think, oh, why is he telling us that? I thought Zen was so wonderfully special, and now I'm disappointed. Well, Shin, trustworthiness, to be honest with oneself and others, and looking at it what it is. If you'd like to believe it's really true, please believe it. But it will not entitle you to the Costanza defense that if you really believe it, it's not a lie. So, no merit. Of course, as a leader of, what does an emperor lead, preside over? A king has a kingdom. What does an emperor have?
An empire.
We are in the empire state here, right? So, the emperor with his empire. It was widely believed if the emperor had enough virtue, crops would grow, rain would fall seasonably, the sun would shine when needed, the wind would blow when needed, and people would be happy. If something was wrong, it could be directly traced back to the lack of virtue of these leading figures. So, Bute or Wu, he was not a dim kind of leader. He saw the Buddhist context and said, I'm going to found some temples. I will ordain some monks. I hope that will create some good karma for me. And then comes Bodhidharma and says, no, sir. Sorry, no such thing. That's dangerous. He could have been executed. Do you know the Japanese word for merit? I gave you one chance, two chances. It appears twice in the reading in the Japanese. It's called kudoku. And it's a word that we have heard before. It's a word that we know from our sutra book. Negawaku wa kono kudoku wo motte ammane kue sai ni o yoboshi warera to shujo to mina tomo ni butsudo jōzen na koto. May we extend this mind over the whole universe so that we and all beings together may attain maturity in Buddha's wisdom. So kudoku appears right there. Negawakua, let us hope, let us aspire, kono kudoku, this merit, this merit. And here's an important thing to understand that is completely foreign to our Western culture, but that is very important in the East Asian culture. And that is this idea of merit. Merit, when we think from the Western point of view, what is merit? A value of something. Some evaluation is involved or some judgment. Your argument has no legal merit. There are merit raises. Did you do a good job at work? You get a merit increase. Academics like to speak about merit. Meritocracy is a way of society. And this Western idea of merit often is in exchange for something, a quid pro quo. That is the kind of merit we think about here in the Western context. It's completely different in the Eastern Asian context. So when I came in and I went to the Butsudan and I purified the tea and then we chanted the Dai Hishu, the great compassionate Dharani. What happens when we are done with it?
We dedicate the merit,
yeah, as a chanting that dedicates the merit. Where is the merit? What merit? So merit in this mindset is something that is generated through our activity together, through our chanting together. Merit is created. It's like we are whipping up some kind of cosmic energy, you know? But it's of a kind that cannot be stashed anywhere. It is created the closer we are in alignment, in concord with the way, as it says in the Shinjin Mei. The more we are together, the more we create that energy that then we freely give away right away. No merit capitalism. It cannot be held onto. But the idea that our common practice creates such merit is an important idea. And what Bodhidharma is telling the emperor here is, well, of course, yeah, you're an emperor, but even you can't hold on to it. Is it that there is no good outcome or no good energy created with the creation of temples and with ordaining people who want to be ordained? Yes, of course. It's so much better than putting up armies that are trained to kill each other. But it's not something that can be held on to. Emperor, do not practice with any thought of gain. Gain is static, is holding on to something. But that's not what it is about. Once this merit is there, it is dedicated to somebody, to something. Buddha nature pervades the universe. That's how many of our echoes in English start. Revealing here and now. With the chanting of this Heart Sutra, we freely give away. I give my life to the Buddha, we say. I give my life to the Dharma. I give my life to the Sangha. without saying that, when we chant, that is the actual act of giving our lives. And to remind us of that, the echo or the dedication is chanted. So one of the things that appeared here was the word ritual, right? How can a Zen person talk about ritual? If you read the Zen stories, you know, you will hear about Tanka. Tanka, the Chinese Zen master who was in a temple in the winter and it was cold. And he just fetched a Buddha statue that was made from wood and made it into pieces of wood and started burning it. They are wonderful Zenga, so little whimsical drawings of that, especially Tanka exposed with his rear end, warming it on the burning Buddha. That is irreverent, isn't it? Isn't it this the opposite? Or when Nansen cuts the cat into two, Joshu's answer is something really weird. That seems to be irreverent to putting his shoe on his head, you know, in front of his teacher. You're supposed to bow, not put your shoe on your head. So we here in the Western culture, for the last couple of hundred years, we are not so hot on ritual. Some reformed religions don't like ritual at all. And even some Orthodox religion gave up on a lot of the ritual. But it is important to understand what the opportunity of being in this kind of environment offers us. The only way that there can be an anti-ritual stance is that there exists a profound appreciation for ritual. The same thing sometimes we say, in order to be informal, you have to have experienced what real strict formality is like. And through having tasted both tastes, then we have a completed palate of what life is like. We also hear about Nen. Every morning, we chant the Kanzeon, 10 Claws, Life Prolonging Sutra. That's really what it means. I don't think that any one of us here chants it for that purpose. Because when you think about it, it won't work. But it talks, there's one word that comes over and over again. Which is the most common word in that sutra? I'll give you some time to think about it. Okay, I'm taking nominations for the most common word in the Kanzeon, the Emmejuku Kanamgyo. Well, somebody's paying attention. So what does Nen mean? Have you ever looked at the character of Nen? It's an interesting character. On the top, that part on the top means now. And the part on the bottom means heart, mind, kokoro. So it's this conjoined character of now and heart. We also hear sometimes, if you're sick in this Sangha, then we send you healing Nen or good Nen. But Nen could also mean present moment, not in the understanding of the Western understanding of present moment. If we think about here and now, and we buy the books by Eckhart Tolle, here and now. That's one idea. But this Nen of now and heart can be understood in a different way. Present moment, there's a sense of an I to be present. I have to be present. I have to notice my body. I have to be mindful of this and that. That is taking the hatchet and cleaving apart the experience of not being bound to that I. Present moment. Present moment without an ego directing anything in it. Attention doesn't need to be directed. As long as we direct any attention to something, we are separate. So Nen is more where your heart and your mind is right now. Not separate. Literally, what is the nature of your heart and mind right now? That is what Nen is. So if we have the feeling, oh, this beloved person is sick, good Nen is that really felt wish and intention of sending that energy towards the healing of that person. So Nen and merit somewhat are of the same nature, of the same nature. Maybe that's the currency. Five Nen. Here comes capitalism again. Nen have no value. They don't last either. Sometimes Nen, people also think it's a thought. It's a thought. And it can be a thought. So if the question is where your heart and mind is right now, then there's thinking Nen as well. And there's awful Nen too. If you think and feel rotten about somebody and I wish this person would, whatever you want to put at the end of the sentence that is non-benevolent, that works as well. But as we live in this universe, everything reflects back to us. We send out those shitty Nen. They will come back and splash on us. I don't know if you know that quote. There's a wonderful quote. Sometimes when I think about some people in the public area who, for the benefit of humanity, they would benefit us if they would decide to depart. We would never think something like that. Mark Twain said, I would never wish ill on anybody, but I have read many an obituary with great pleasure. So, this weekend session, when we are here, yes, we are in the Buddhist context of rei, of manners and ritual, of doing it in a specific way. Not because this is a solution. No. This is a way of training ourselves, of training ourselves to be able to be free from all of that, to be free from, well, what fetters could be worse than these? There are so many. They are all the same. So if we learn to develop this kind of freedom of heart, of mind, within a context like this, in silence, with chanting, with bowing, completely disappearing, we can take that from there through our bodies through our embodiment of human-heartedness, of doing the right thing, treating this universe, the Sangha, which is all sentient and insentient beings, with compassion, loving kindness, with the wisdom and the honest presentation of who we are. Then this practice is worthwhile doing it. There's nothing academic here. Well, we can talk about things that's like maybe also just a tool sometimes to help us get a little longer while we are in a difficult stretch, or have the opportunity to look closer onto one specific aspect that we need to look at. We made 4 new Dharma teachers at the beginning of this retreat. It's a wonderful step for the society forward into this direction of having the richness, I would say, that Rinzai Zen ought to have. It seems hierarchical sometimes, so the manners and the rules here might seem hierarchical. But I want everybody to understand that these rules and manners are customs that ought to manifest that human-heartedness and Buddha nature. They are functions. I sit here functioning as somebody who is charged with giving a talk. Teisho means to expose, elucidate through one's being, not through the words that come from a speaker. Being a Dharma teacher, being a Dharma student, being an ever-maturing human being is to be that, to be a light upon this world that shines everywhere, like the sun, without discrimination, without resentment, unobstructed. So, tomorrow we'll have a talk about Dr. Martin Luther King and his heritage, and what it means for us living in these times. So when we chant in the morning, and even though we have an echo, a dedication, what merit do we have accumulated? None whatsoever. So what should we do? Let's chant again. Let's leave this building after the retreat. Let's smile at the person we meet on the street. And kudoku is transferred. The light shines. And, well, at least I feel there's hope for this place. Even New York City. Even the United States. Even this planet. Even each of us can do this.
This has been a Zen Studies Society podcast. If you found it to be of interest, please consider making a donation by visiting zenstudies.org/donate. Thank you for listening.